this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Mr. Morpheus? Do y'all like music? Mr. Morpheus is a one-man band whose style is of the same grit and grace which shaped hillbilly music and blues of the early 1900s. He sings and whistles as he plays the guitar, harmonica, and kazoo, all while playing the bass drum and tambourine with his feet. More can be found at mrmorpheus.blogspot.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a special edition of Tales from the South, our Season 8 finale show, where Southerners bring their own true best stories of the year to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show and prizes are sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Little Rock native Mark Simpson was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Lariah Eubanks, and our featured piece is this piece right over here entitled The Porch, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Lariah at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some winning Southern-style storytelling? Tonight is part two of our season 8 finale with two of our four runners up and the second of our two grand prize winners. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Let's start the night with runner-up Bruce Snow, who is soon knee-deep in water in Foul Weather Friend.
In August 2005, my grandparents were in Florida visiting their youngest daughter, while I, my disabled mother, my uncle and his wife held down the fort at the family home on Mandeville Street in the Gentilly neighborhood of New Orleans. We entertained the idea of evacuating as we watched the massive storm fill the Gulf of Mexico, but in the end decided that it was our duty to stay with the house and protect our home, the legacy of success achieved by two young immigrants who had come from Ecuador penniless in the early 60s. No hurricane had ever caused us much trouble before, so we agreed to ride it out. Little did we know that this hurricane would be different. This was Katrina. The electricity went out and the wind howled. The rain came down in blinding sheets as we huddled in the narrow hallway for protection. Everyone was frightened, including my little dog, Dolja. I had first met Dolja 3 months before my 18th birthday. Found wandering the streets, he made a pitiful sight. Small and black with short hair, he had a long gray tail and brown around his muzzle. A little guy, part miniature pincher, part rat terrier. He was completely afraid. I'd never met a dog who was so scared of people. If you stood over him and to lean down to pet him, he would cower down and shake and shiver. Wherever he'd come from, he wasn't treated nicely. It broke my heart. I had taken him home, given him a bath, and named him Dolja. And now as Katrina bore down on us, I held him close to me as he and I trembled. The sound the wind made was like ghosts passing through your soul. There wasn't much else to think about except your own mortality, and it was too loud for any distracting conversation anyway. The mind was pinned down by the sound. After about 3 hours of this torment, the rain slackened and stopped. The wind howled fiercely, but without the rain to lash out and be its voice, it also became less frightening. My uncle and I decided to go out for a quick look around. I'd been cradling Dolja for hours. His warmth and his soft fur were comforting to stroke, and though he wasn't comfortable at all, I passed him to my mother to hold, and we set out. What we saw gave us little reassurance. Down trees and limbs, and nearly every awning on every house blown away. But that wasn't the worst of it. We saw the water. Unknown to us at the time, the London Avenue Canal had broken its levees less than a mile from our home. Instead of water draining, it was gushing out of every storm drain and manhole in sight. In less than 3 hours, the exterior steps, which connected the main house to my apartment, were submerged, and though we tried to barricade the doorways, the old hardwood floors proved no match for the rising tide. We grabbed what we could from the kitchen, grabbed the dog, and retreated to the attic. The wind still howled fiercely, and we were defeated. We had little food, and all of the water containers we'd filled from the bathtub, well, they were underwater now too. I climbed out of the attic window, which leads to the roof, and watched the sun set on my submerged neighborhood alone. The next day, we were freed from our roof by neighbors we'd never met, wandering by on a fishing boat. I cut a line of phone cord running through the attic and made Dolja an impromptu leash. My mother was recovering from a hysterectomy and gamma knife surgery for a benign brain tumor. All her medication was underwater. She assured us she was strong enough to make the roughly 6 mile hike to the Superdome, where food, water, and medical services would await us. We began our march up Elysian Fields Avenue to get to Interstate 610, the quickest way to the stadium. You can live your entire life in the city of New Orleans and never realize just how the ground slopes. We started off in water only ankle deep, not so bad. Picked up the dog and kept going. Then our knees were under, to the waist, and finally the water was up to our shoulders. We stopped. There were 2 more blocks to the interstate ramp. I was balancing a squirming little black mud on the crown of my head. Once again, we were rescued by people in a boat, New Orleans police this time. We reached the highway and started trekking for the Superdome. Unsurprisingly, there was a long line to get in. Bags were being checked for weapons and drugs, etc. The young National Guardsman who began to look us over said we were okay, but the dog couldn't come in. It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. I tied the end of his phone cord to a piece of barricade set out with other unhappy animals tied to it. I hugged Dolja and told him I loved him, I was sorry, but that we had to go. The man said SPA personnel were en route to see to the animals. And when this thing cleared up, I vowed to find him, to bring him home no matter what. The other animals, dogs and cats tied to this barricade, all looked crazed and dazed and were chewing at their tethers trying to free themselves. I looked at my own and knew I was feeding him and myself a bowl of foul-tasting lies. My mother volunteered to wait outside with them, but we dragged her in with us while he shrieked with fear as we walked away. I didn't look back. Once inside, it didn't take long before my mother slowed her pace as we ascended bank after bank of stairs. I turned around and she was gone. 20 minutes later, she reappeared with Dolja cradled in her arms. She didn't really explain how she did it, and I was too grateful to ask. The next morning, I shared one of the most memorable breakfasts I'll ever have in my entire life with my little black dog on the field of the Superdome at the 40-yard line, huddled underneath the opposing team's benches. We ate bread and peanut butter from an MRE, and he drank water from my cupped hand. In a week, we'd be in Florida with my aunt and grandparents, still trying to wash off the grime from those long days in late August and early September 2005. Years would pass, and Dolja moved to South Texas with my mom, still sick, and my beautiful grandparents. The prospect of rebuilding just seemed like too much for them and their memories. I found myself in Little Rock, Arkansas, of all places, in love and engaged to be married. The wedding was scheduled for December the 21st, 2010, and to my delight, Dolja would be making the trip to New Orleans for the ceremony. When I saw him, I couldn't believe my eyes. He was old now, over 13 years. He had trouble walking and seemed almost totally blind. My mother told me he'd had what she thought was a stroke a few months ago and hadn't told me because she didn't want to upset me. He would just lie in a heap on the carpet and breathe painfully. I laid down next to him and pet my old friend. Despite his pain and all of the strength it must have taken, he raised himself up, came to me and began to sniff. I hadn't seen him but maybe a couple of days in 5 years, but he remembered me. He sniffed me and pressed himself against me and licked the hand he'd lapped water from on the artificial turf of a football stadium years before. He died 4 days later on Christmas Eve, and though it tore me apart inside, I felt a definite sense of pride that it was me who had rescued him from a life of fear and probable death as a stray pup, who'd carried him through the turgid waters of our flooded city and held him while he was still warm after he'd died. That it was me who had the honor of burying him hundreds of miles from our then respective homes, but in our hometown. And as the rain came down on Christmas morning, that Christmas I wrapped and delivered a present I will truly never forget.
When he isn't driving a streetcar through Argenta in downtown Little Rock, New Orleans native Bruce Snow can be found playing music with his band, Mutations of Thursday. He lives in Sherwood, Arkansas with his wife, daughter, and menagerie of beloved critters. Next, runner-up J.W. Taylor's hormones get the best of him in The Confession.
It was 1 a.m. when Brother Benji set me and Dana McDuffie down in his office. Dana was looking at me, and Brother Benji too, but I focused on the cross on the wall behind his desk and tried to breathe. "You kids have two options," he said. "Option one, I pick up that phone, call your parents, and tell them to come get you, and I'll let you explain why. Now, brothers and sisters, listen to me. I didn't care if option two meant being stripped naked, dipped in honey, and rolled in fire ants while singing all six verses of Amazing Grace. I was going with option number two. Now, I knew Brother Benji wouldn't kill me and bury me in the backyard, but I wasn't so sure about Mama. I was 14, the summer of 1985, the night of the youth lock-in at Calvary Baptist in Shreveport, Louisiana. For the teenagers, a church lock-in was a stay-up-as-late-as-you-like extravaganza, a night away from home with movies, music, pizza, games, and a bit of hair pulling mixed with the occasional slap fight. For the parents, it was even better. With a promise to pick them up at 8 the next morning, they began dropping their darlings off at 6 p.m., and by 6:15, the church parking lot was enveloped in a thick black fog smelling suspiciously of burning rubber. The man in charge of the 40-plus teens was Brother Benji, the youth minister, who was an angry little man with slumped shoulders, a squatty face, thick glasses, and the joyful spirit of a man under a perpetual IRS audit. He had shooed us into the fellowship hall and led us in prayer before outlining the rules that no one in the room intended to follow. Then he turned us loose. I grabbed some pizza and talked to some friends, all while watching Dana McDuffie. For weeks, Dana and I had been engaged in that time-honored teenage courtship ritual of circling each other like feral cats. Staring and preening and puffing, neither willing to make the first move. Feats of strength and fluttered lashes, a bicep flex and a hair flip. Cologne and perfume applied in such copious amounts that we could smell one another through walls. It was all prelude and preparation for tonight. I decided tonight was the night. But I was nervous. I was new to the game of love, but Dana had what we in the evangelical community called a reputation. And unlike leprosy or rickets, you couldn't take vitamin D or rub some aloe vera on a reputation and make it all better. A reputation was terminal. But I didn't care. I decided. So around midnight, when I found Dana alone as she was coming out of the girls' bathroom, I made my move. "Want to talk?" That was my move. I had practiced it for weeks in the mirror, but then Dana threw me a curveball. Talk about what? Now, if my move had been a ship, they'd have been ringing bells and handing out life jackets because there was 6 foot of water in the boiler room. In my practice mirror sessions, Dana had always responded either yes or no. I was woefully unprepared for her to answer my question with a question. So I just stood there in the wreckage of my move, the smell of my own sweat and a half bottle of Stetson burning my nostrils. Dana gave me kind of a sideways look, like the RCA dog. And then she smiled, and she grabbed my hand, and we ran through a side door into the church courtyard. We found another open door, and she led me up some stairs and down some others until eventually we arrived in the elementary Sunday school wing. At the end of a long hall, we opened the door to the first grade classroom. I turned on the light. She turned it off. Shortly thereafter, we commenced descending. Now, I may have been new to the game of love, but it didn't take me long to figure out that we weren't playing the same game. Dana was playing bridge and chess and backgammon all at the same time. I was hitting rocks with hammers. Yet, just about the time I was learning how to hold my own, I was blinded by a bright light, not unlike what I imagine Saul experienced on the road to Damascus. Only instead of God's voice, I heard Brother Benji's. And to this day, I don't know how he found us or how he even knew we were missing. But he had called us at play on the fields of love, and he promptly called the game on account of darkness in our souls. And so the long, slow walk back to his office. He sat us down and shut the door, took off his thick glasses and tossed them on his desk. He rubbed his wee little face, rubbed it again. I looked at Dana. She looked at me. Silence. "You should be ashamed," he said. "Ashamed. This is God's house, a place of worship, and you two have turned it into a den of iniquity." Thus began an impromptu sermon on the evils of the flesh. And as he spoke, I was struck by two almost simultaneous revelations. One, for the first time in my life, I was a fornicator. Two, I should not have been quite so happy about it. I had committed a real, live, grown-up sin, and it was all I could do to keep the smile in my heart from reaching my face. But my parents didn't take me to church every Wednesday and twice on Sunday for nothing. My temporary euphoria was replaced by the cold and creeping feeling that now, after 14 years, all 10 of the commandments were suddenly in play. Instead of just keeping the Sabbath holy and honoring my mom and dad, now I had to watch out for coveting my neighbor's wife, along with bearing false witness, whatever that was, and murdering and thieving and adultery. A whole new world was opening up, and I was afraid it was going to swallow me whole. "Are you listening?" Brother Benji said. "Yes, sir." Then he gave us the options. Call our parents, or option two. And so it came to pass that option number two led us back to the fellowship hall, to a small raised stage in the front of the room. The congregation before us, Brother Benji behind us. And in a loud voice, Brother Benji did say, "J.W. Taylor, confess before your peers and your God." And lo, I froze. Never had 40 plus teenagers been so quiet. The whole scene seemed like a photograph, a still life. No one was moving except me. As bad as I was shaking on the outside, it was worse on the inside. Voices and laws and rules and commandments were swirling in my head. Love and lust and heaven and hell all blurred together until I couldn't figure out what I needed to confess because I couldn't keep track of all my sins. "J.W.," the voice said. Dana took my hand. Her hand was as warm as mine was cold. I took a deep, shaky breath and said, "Me and Dana went to the Sunday school rooms and kissed and stuff." The voice. And what you did was wrong, wasn't it? Yes, sir. And you won't do it again, will you? No, sir. Dana let go of my hand. I had a lot to learn. And again, the voice. Dana McDuffie, confess before your peers and your God. And then it happened. Dana took two steps forward to the front and center of the stage, and she confessed, and confessed, and confessed. In fact, she confessed in such vivid and salacious detail that Brother Benji tried to keep her from confessing anymore. But that only made her confess louder. And the louder she confessed, the smaller Brother Benji became, until he receded completely into the background of the great passion play that was unfolding before him. And the more Dana confessed about what had transpired in that first grade Sunday school room, the more I began to wonder whether I'd even been there. It was a tour de force of repentance. And when Dana finally finished her stem-winding confession, the wee little man behind her didn't ask if what she had done was wrong or if she was going to do it again. He just stepped down off the stage and walked right out the doors of the fellowship hall, leaving me and Dana and our peers and our God to figure out what to do next. When I woke up later that morning, Dana was gone. My parents picked me up and I rode home in silence. I went to bed and slept another 6 hours without dreaming a single dream. I never saw Dana McDuffie inside the walls of Calvary Baptist Church again, but I saw her again the next Friday night, and the one after that, and the one after that.
J.W. Taylor is an Arkansas native living in Little Rock with his wife Jennifer and daughters Elizabeth and Catherine. This is his second appearance on our Best Of show. In our final story of the night, it's the second of our two grand prize winners, John Horner Jacobs, on a road trip in George Paul.
In 1996, I was 27 and going on my 14th year of adolescence. I'd watched as my friends had outpaced and then lapped me in the mad dash to adulthood, office jobs, wives, children. And sometimes I wondered at my inability to make lasting connections or gain the respect I thought I deserved. It happens like this. It doesn't always happen like this, not always, but it starts this way. The phone rings, I pick it up, and George Paul Eldridge starts talking. Two words for you, he says, excited. R.V. That's two letters, I say. Shut up, man. Recreational vehicle. We're taking the Moho to Lou's wedding. The plan is this. Get Daniel, Woodyard, Reisner, Gernati, Boyce, Eldridge, and me in his father's RV, a threadbare and beaten-down specimen of recreational vehicle, tan and grimy with a dank, musky smell, and fill it to bursting with booze and gasoline. Leave in the late afternoon and drive to Chicago throughout the night, a movable feast. There's no reason to attend a wedding if you can't start drinking 9 hours early. On the day of the trip, Eldridge keeps calling it the Moho, and there's vigorous debate about what the Mo stands for. Half of us are in the motor camp, and the other half in the mobile contingent. Eldridge lays down the law. It's a motorhome, dudes. Don't be silly. You don't put gas in a house trailer. Historically, Interstate 40 East from Little Rock to Memphis is one of the worst stretches of highway in the nation. But we're doing just fine, the Moho shuddering and rocking on well-lubed shocks. Other than himself, Eldridge will allow only Reisner behind the wheel. And Reisner's driving now, smoking and mauling the wheel with big, raw-boned hands. We've all picked out seats and the cases of beer sit ice in the shower stall, along with the party ball. A translucent amber 3-gallon globe of beer. Chips and pretzels lie in bright particulate sprays on the mangy carpet. The trash bags bulge with empty Solo cups and crushed beer cans. The RV cab has taken on a yeasty smell. But spirits are high. Gernati and Woodyard discuss the Bulls, the phenomenal power of Scottie Pippen and Michael Jordan, while Daniel chats with Boyce about law school and what he refers to as lawyering. Even the flat tire we have near Memphis isn't enough to dampen the spirits. It's just a 2-hour delay, and most of that's due to a truck stop mechanic's trying to figure out how to put the hub lock back on the patched tire. On the road again, Eldridge says, I was hanging out with Levon the other day. He matches a cigarette and takes a drink from a light beer. George Paul Eldridge is excitable, in addition to having two first names. A dark-haired, olive-complexioned man, he prefers brightly colored clothes with stripes and tends to wear his pants high on his waist. He often punctuates his conversation with high kicks and air guitar. Unlike most of my high school friends, he manages to ride the line between respectable adult and nocturnal party monster. His father is a restaurateur, and Eldridge is active in the Memphis scene, booking bands for Blues City Cafe and fundraising for the King Biscuit Blues Festival. After the show, we went back to Levon's hotel, Eldridge says. Well, you're pretty lit, you know. He orders some food, but he barely touched it. Eldridge talks often about musicians, and being a musician myself, sometimes it's hard to take. He rattles off famous folk like Albert King, James Cotton, Levon Helm, all musical heroes of mine, as if he's on a first-name basis with them. He might be. I don't know. Most of them have some connection to Arkansas, so it's possible. So, Eldridge says, I snatched up his rice pudding because Levon didn't want it. He's lying in bed and the TV's on, right? And damn, it's delicious. But that's the way the whiskey's got me, you know? Levon says, you know what makes that pudding so good? And I say, what? Levon says, that Arkansas basmati rice. Woodyard and Boyce laugh. The mojo shudders and sways. Reasoner calls for a piss break, and Eldridge goes to the front of the mojo. He cries, it's a fusion! As he slips behind the wheel, and Reasoner slips out. Eldridge throws his highest approbation, the heavy metal devil sign. We never slow under 70, and no one spills a drop. It's night now, and we've been on the road long enough so that everyone's buzzed. Boyce unlimbers the whiskey bottle, and Daniel wants me to uncase the guitar and run through a few numbers. I want to play originals, but that's quickly shouted down. I play Rocky Raccoon and Melissa and Midnight Rider and Willing up on Cripple Creek and Ophelia. Even though we're traveling, musically, we don't stray too far from home. If you're a guitar player in the 90s, someone calling for Freebird is to be expected and dealt with accordingly. But someone calling for the band's The Weight is taken very seriously. I run through the intro, work through the first verse and chorus. It's a great song because it has no bridge, just chorus, verse, chorus, all the way through. And we get to the part where everyone's singing about taking a load off Annie and hitting the three-point harmony of Ann. We never reach Put the Load Right on Me. Abruptly, the whole world shifts and slows. Daniel's mouth is an open bell, maybe from the last lyric of The Weight, or maybe from the beginning of a scream. Boyce's arms are splayed out, his face a study in alarm. The whole cab of the mojo has lurched and shifted, tilting on axis. A tremendous metal tearing sound howls through the cab. Beer spill to the floor. A whiskey bottle topples. Reasoner grips the wheel, shoulders hunched. He's the only person not screaming. It's 2 a.m. outside of Mattoon, Illinois, and the wheels have come off the mojo. When it finally slews to a stop, we disembark the crippled vehicle like stunned astronauts from a crash landing. We find the wheels in a cornfield a mile or so away. We've left a 100-yard scratch on the surface of the interstate. Everyone praises Reasoner for his quick thinking. The mojo could have easily flipped and rolled if he'd pumped the brakes and we'd all be dead. Eldridge jabs a finger at me. You, intellectual, he says. Turns to Reasoner. You, plumber. Walk into town and get a wrecker. It takes 8 hours to get the wheels put back on the mojo. By the time we reach Chicago in the hotel, it's been 24 hours since we left Little Rock. After the close confines of the journey, Eldridge disappears. When he finally reappears the next day, it's minutes before the rehearsal dinner, and he's wearing a brand new green seersucker suit. The tag's still on, with white bucks. He's energetically drunk. He's been watching the Bulls at a local sports bar for most of the day, drinking margaritas. But why a green seersucker, Lewis the Green Mass? Aren't seersuckers supposed to be blue-striped? We were drinking margaritas. Ow! Eldridge says, then performs a high kick, his white buck flashing near eye level. Badass, isn't it? The rest of the wedding weekend goes smooth enough. Gernotti falls down a flight of stairs. Reisner picks a fight with a red-haired guy. All of us are bounced out of a strip club, and the cashiers at the Wiener Circle heap abuse on us. On Sunday, as we're packing to leave, Eldridge tosses the keys of the Moho to Reisner and says, get her back safely, man. I'm flying home. He turns and saunters off, pants cinched, grandpa high around his waist. Time passes. Eldridge and I fall out of touch. I'm playing in a band, and we're getting pretty good, but Eldridge ignores all my requests for booking, and that smarts some. But I've managed to convince a lovely girl that I'm worth spending time with and decide to go back to school. I get a phone call from George Paul. One word, man. It's called Neris. I think that's an anagram, I say. Shut up. It's a dinner. The people who do the Grammys, they're throwing it for Rufus Thomas's birthday at B.B. King's Club, right? I want you to come. I drive up to Augusta, Arkansas, and meet him. Eldridge now lives in his family's ancestral home and drives between Memphis and Helena for his band booking and King Biscuit fundraising responsibilities. We barrel along a small two-lane blacktop. Eldridge drives a Suburban, and we've started drinking early enough to be tight when we arrive at BB's on Beals, where the event is being held. Front loading, George Paul says to me, winking, lifting a tall boy to his mouth. AC/DC comes on the radio, and Eldridge reaches over to turn it up and throw me the metal devil sign, index and pinky high. There's a small sound, growing louder, and then Eldridge yanks the wheel over, laughing. We've drifted into the oncoming lane and run a car off the road. When we arrive at the nearest dinner, the blues band's in full swing. George Paul introduces me to Rufus Thomas of Walking the Dog fame, and we take our seats next to an older African-American gentleman wearing sunglasses at night, a blind blues man whose name I don't catch. The band, after their set, lets some mic feedback get away from them. It rises into an atonal scream. The blues man raises his hands to cover his ears. They say that when you're blind, all the other senses become more acute. Once the band has the feedback under control, Eldridge leans in close to the blind man and says clearly, "Hurts so good." Dinner and the drive back to Augusta are uneventful. I don't hear from Eldridge again. A few months later, Boyce calls me to say George Paul's been in an accident. He borrowed his cousin's cherry apple red Corvette. I can imagine Eldridge high-kicking in glee and wrapped it around a tree, crushing his skull. They keep him on life support long enough for us to say goodbye. His father greets me at the hospital saying, "It's a bad deal, John, a bad deal." The day of the funeral is brutally hot, 100 degrees easily. The cotton and beans are already green in the fields that run up and kiss the Eldridge property where George Paul will be laid to rest. I'm honored to be a pallbearer, and that thought keeps running through my mind, pallbearer, pallbearer, George pallbearer. But I'm dripping with sweat inside my suit, worried my hands will be too slick to keep hold of the coffin. And I'm crying, selfishly, I'm crying, because all grief is about the living. After the minister says the words and the family tosses their handfuls of dust on the lowering coffin, Levon Helm and James Cotton step forward. It's been rumored that they'd come, but this is the first I've seen of them. They raise their harmonicas and offer up a slow, swelling rendition of Amazing Grace. On cue, a breeze begins to blow through the mourners, and there's a brief relief from the heat, as if this were some scene in a movie. Afterward, we stand about in the shade outside the Augusta house where George Paul had lived his last few months. Boyce and Reisner, Daniel and Lewis, Gernotti and Woodyard, all of the boys are there, smoking cigarettes and drinking sweet tea, each of us trying to understand what has happened. A black SUV pulls up and Levon Helm gets out, accompanied by some friends and handlers. He's an Arkansan, after all, and his roots here run deep. A small man and very lean, he's swallowed by his jacket. He totters over to us, pulls out a rumpled pack of menthol cigarettes from a pocket and says, "You boys got a light?" We fetch him sweet tea and we stand there in the fading afternoon sun, motes of cottonwood hanging in the air. while Levon tells us jokes and laughs and does what he can to ease our dismay in the face of the grave. For us boys, it's the first whiff of death. The conversation stills, and he looks out at the field where George Paul is buried. Then he pats my shoulder and says, "You're a hoss, ain't you, son? You the player that George Paul told me about?" And we talk music for a bit, and I tell him how much joy his songs have given me over the years. When his handlers come to fetch him, he says, "You come on up to Woodstock and visit, all right? We got all sorts of music coming through there." And he's gone, handlers whisking him back into the big black vehicle and driving off down the graveled road, back to the highway.
Little Rock native John Horner Jacobs is an award-winning author whose first novel, Southern Gods, was shortlisted for the Bram Stoker Award, and whose latest novel, The Twelve-Fingered Boy, was just released to critical acclaim. His first fantasy series, The Incorruptibles, will be published in spring 2014. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argento Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
The lanterns were shining, the beer glasses clinking, the saloon doors a swinging, and in come a stranger with a gun on his bone skinny waist, his eye on the card game, a gambler's grin on his face. It was rowdy and late, all the drinking and gaming started to weigh on the broke poker players. You could tell it was time to go home unless you wanna get beat. But the last hand was laid on the table, and sure as a message crossed cable, the boys got angry and started to make for their pistols, calling him cheat. But he drew with unnerving speed, shot around through the window and out in the street. You could hear it go humming and singing around in the night. The stranger arose, holstered his gun, picked his purse from the table, and walked to the stable. That bullet kept ricochet ringing around in the quiet. And cheating, we were unfairly beaten, no different than stealing. A stampeding mob surrounded the stable. Come out, you're arrested for those you have robbed. The stranger came quickly, no gun belt was with him. They tied up his hands and demanded his purse, asking the stable, "They've got all my things, and they're putting the tack on my newly bought horse." "You won't need your things long, you'll surely be hanged. These men have all witnessed the wrong you have done." So they walked out his pony, set him upon it, and rode to the gallows to see him well strung. We'll be right back. the lanterns a flicker. With the rope round the stranger, they let his horse loose. But again came the twang of the wild ricochet. It sent his horse running and cut through the noose. So you might be a-thinking, this sounds mighty strange. Even old Annie Oakley hadn't that kind of aim. But the lesson's the same. If you meet with a stranger, don't put up a wager you can't stand to lose.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.